Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the New York Times tells readers Barack Obama was moved to negotiate a deal with Iran because of his personal faith in diplomacy. Is that an appropriate way to understand how these negotiations came to be? Our guest has an alternate view. We'll hear from investigative journalist Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis: The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Also on the show, almost as disheartening as it is that this week marks the first time a sitting president will visit a federal prison, is the notion that such symbolic acts, like that of commuting the sentences of a few dozen prisoners, might be mistaken for substantive movement toward fundamental change in the criminal justice system. How hopeful is current talk of reform? And should reform define the limit of the change we want to see? We'll talk with Mohammed Sheikh of the group Critical Resistance about that. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. If you follow campaign coverage closely, you'll hear a lot about issues, but you likely won't learn a lot about issues because the policies that candidates propose are generally treated as buzzwords with little examination of the consequences these proposals would be likely to have for voters. That's certainly true of education, whose role in campaign coverage was explored by educator Molly Neffel in a recent article for Fair.org. On the Republican side, the phrase du jour is raising expectations, which is equated with endorsing the federal Common Core standards. Political reporters examine whether or not candidates flip-flopped on Common Core, a phrase the Washington Post has used to describe both Chris Christie and Bobby Jindal, but not whether the expectations Common Core is trying to raise are actually developmentally appropriate. Educational experts and educators have serious doubts about that, but bringing in their expertise would mean straying off the campaign trail and possibly missing a stumble in the horse race. For Democrats, the key word is overhaul, as in efforts to overhaul public education, evoking tuning up an engine. The actual content of what advocates of overhaul have in mind, beginning with closing down public schools and replacing them with privately run charters, is rarely acknowledged. And there's the ubiquitous accountability, which in practice means punishing and rewarding teachers based on the results of standardized testing that many find deeply flawed in design and implementation. Such is the level of campaign issues coverage. Readers encounter that freighted word tossed off in asides like that by New York Times business columnist David Leonard, that part of the reason teachers and parents are frustrated by testing is that accountability isn't fun. Well, the 4th of July holiday weekend came and went, with the FBI terror warning hyped by the media, foreshadowing nothing more than two false alarms and a handful of canceled plans. So, as Adam Johnson noted on Fair.org, it was curious when the following Thursday, the FBI asserted to CNN that a number of ISIS-inspired terror plots had been thwarted from coast to coast in recent weeks. Quote, including plots timed to the July 4th holiday weekend, U.S. officials tell CNN, close quote. No evidence was provided beyond the word of U.S. officials. USA Today reported FBI Director James Comey saying authorities, quote, disrupted an undisclosed number of plots timed to the July 4th holiday, close quote. And some 10 people were arrested recently, quote, on charges related to their association with ISIL, close quote. Then there was Pete Williams on NBC News reporting Comey's claim that, quote, those inspired by ISIS don't make elaborate plans and often act on the spur of the moment. It's actually hard to figure out when they're trying to kill somebody, Comey said. And you cannot say, well, we've got to do it on the 4th, because you know you have people who are motivated to kill people and they are unreliable in terms of when they're going to act, close quote. So the arrests were of people without elaborate plans who are unreliable in terms of when they're going to act, and it's not even clear that they were intending to act since it's hard to figure out when they're trying to kill somebody. What's not hard is to get media to not just report as fact, but to hype these planless, unreliably scheduled attacks, and to do so without critical assessment of their political context. FBI Director Comey, for example, testified before Congress recently about the importance of being able to get around encryption software in order to fight terror. And lawmakers, the Washington Post reported, are looking to step up FBI surveillance of social media to prevent ISIS recruiting online by forcing social media companies to monitor and report terrorist content. And finally, the New York Times public editor Margaret Sullivan was called on to suggest that, no, it really wasn't a good idea to run that piece by Ben Rothenberg about how Serena Williams, at the time about to seal her sixth victory at Wimbledon, has, quote, large biceps and a mold-breaking muscular frame, close quote, and how, quote, her rivals could try to emulate her physique, but most of them choose not to, close quote, followed by the comment from another player's coach of his client that, quote, first of all, she's a woman and she wants to be a woman, close quote. As readers variously sighed and choked on coffee, the Times seemed to feel they were doing something groundbreaking with a 2015 story about how, quote, for many, perceived ideal feminine body type can seem at odds with the best physique for tennis success, close quote. Sullivan's column reflects the disagreement of many who didn't think Rothenberg's good intentions sufficient to save a piece that, besides trotting out what is actually a really old narrative about women's sports, Professor Pat Griffin points out, didn't even get at the barely veiled racism and sexism embedded in many of the attacks on Williams, which are certainly worth coverage. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Last fall, the PBS NewsHour referred to the need for Iran to persuade the world it wasn't going to get weapons in return for lifting sanctions. NBC's David Gregory said the international community, divided on many things, are united on this. Quote, they think Iran is up to no good and wants to build a nuclear weapon, close quote. U.S. corporate media have a habit when discussing Iran, though not only then, of presenting what are overwhelmingly U.S. points of view as those of the whole world, a less than helpful quality as we try to understand the deal with Iran currently making headlines. Here to help us sort through it is investigative journalist Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, and a regular contributor to Middle East Eye. Welcome back to Counterspin, Gareth Porter.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeannie.
Well, let's leap right in. Media are calling the deal historic and crucial to Obama's legacy, for good or for ill. But you wrote recently that media are rather missing the import of these negotiations and of how they came about. What are they missing? What's the more appropriate takeaway, if you will?
Well, of course, there's a great deal that the media is missing about the background of this because of the fact that the media has been basically applying a false narrative to the entire issue of Iran nuclear program for so long. And that means that they are missing essentially the entire true history of the program. In my focus on one particular issue, I don't mean to suggest that this is by any means the only problem with the news media interpretation or take on the Iran nuclear deal. But what I thought was particularly appropriate at this point is to look back and see how did the U.S. come to the point where it was ready to negotiate a deal on the nuclear program with Iran. And the answer to that is certainly not something that you will learn from reading the news media accounts. I've been following this for some years now, and what struck me about the relevant history here is that, in fact, if you go back to the 1990s, the people within Iran who are part of this very strong, the most powerful political faction in the country, really, the Rafsanjani faction, named after the former president Rafsanjani, who wanted to integrate Iran into the global capitalist economy and realized that their only hope for doing that was to reach some kind of an agreement with the United States, really began in the late 1980s and early 1990s to engage the United States diplomatically and politically. And what happened was that the United States was simply not interested, either under the H.W. Bush administration or the Clinton administration, and certainly not the George W. Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
Why did the United States not take any interest in diplomatic engagement with Iran? Because at that point, Iran was simply too weak, and the disparity in power with the United States was simply too great. The United States government did not see any compelling strategic reason to have a negotiating process with Iran. In my book, I point out quite precisely in the very early 1990s when the Bush administration at that time basically shifted a policy that had been planned to be carried out by the White House to reciprocate a gesture by Rafsanjani in helping to release U.S. hostages in Lebanon by essentially making some public concession or gesture to Iran. And instead of doing that, in the wake of the victory over Iraq, the administration decided they didn't really need Iran at all in their plans for the Middle East and simply embarked on a new period of hostility toward Iran. So that was the beginning of this 25-year period, essentially, of U.S. being much less interested in reaching agreement with Iran than Iran was. That's been misunderstood because Iran has not simply said to the United States, we'll do whatever you want to have an agreement with you. They wanted the United States to lift the sanctions. And that was the primary issue for many years. And the United States wasn't willing to do that. So it was not really until the second Obama administration that the United States really deigned to enter into a fundamental negotiating process with Iran. Up until that time, the posture of the United States was, we will put pressure on Iran to force it to give up its nuclear program, or we're really not interested in doing that. We'll just carry out regime change, as was the case with the Bush administration. What I'm really talking about here is the impact of the vast disparity in power between the United States and Iran and how that has shaped the history of the whole question of diplomatic engagement between two countries.
Hearing about Obama's efforts at coercion and sort of threats of regime change, it's very interesting in light of coverage like the New York Times story I just saw that talked about how this deal is due to Obama's faith in diplomacy, you know, as though that were an abiding characteristic of this White House's posture towards Iran. But just to spell it out, when you're talking about the shift in power relations that, you know, Iran didn't suddenly start wanting sanctions lifted. That's been their goal for a long time. What changed did have to do with Iran's nuclear program. That's what's played the role in shifting the power.
It was precisely the fact that the Iranians began in 2006 to not only enrich uranium, but to essentially build up a stockpile of low-enriched uranium. And then, in 2010, in order to get the attention of the Obama administration, to get it to agree to negotiations, the Iranians began to enrich uranium to the level of 20%, which was regarded as an alarming sign by the Obama administration. And that was certainly one of the things that prompted Obama to decide that it was time to begin a process of negotiations. But it was also the failure of the pressure on Iran through, of course, the economic sanctions beginning in 2012, but also the failure of cyber attacks in 2009 and 2012, and the exploitation by the Obama administration of the at least implicit threat of an attack on the Iranian nuclear program by the Israelis. So that combination of pressures, which Obama hoped would bring about a shift in Iranian negotiating posture, failed, and therefore Obama is really compelled, I think, to finally go into a real negotiating situation with Iran.
Well, as we now read about working things out at the table rather than on the battlefield, I think it seems worth saying that when you hear a bland phrase like economic measures or sanctions, there's real harm there, you know. I mean, it's not as though sanctions, well, of course they are not war, it's not as though they have a light or a non-noteworthy impact on society. And Iran had been in this unique, strange legal status for a long time.
That's right. Of course, it does have an impact on society. It has political and social implications, broadly speaking, for Iran. And at the same time, one has to understand that it's also a matter of national pride. It's a symbolic insult to Iran to be in that situation. So there are multiple reasons why Iran was so strongly motivated, going back really to the mid-1990s, when the United States first imposed unilateral economic sanctions, basically a complete trade embargo on Iran, to really remove all the sanctions that they could.
Well, I'm going to refer people to your piece on MiddleEastEye.net for further elaboration of these ideas. I just want to ask you finally, Gareth Porter, what do you know about the Iranian public reaction to the deal? They're almost entirely missing from U.S. media's story. What's the reaction there?
I think there's overwhelming welcoming of the agreement and worry that somehow it's not going to work out the way they hope. Certainly the Iranian people have been subjected to so many disappointments over the years in general regarding the relationship with, or non-relationship with the United States, that there's certainly a great deal of caution about not being too overjoyed by this and just waiting to see how it's going to work out.
We've been speaking with Gareth Porter. His book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And you can find his recent reporting on the Iran deal on MiddleEastEye.net. Gareth Porter, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thanks, Janine.
Media are talking of an unprecedented bipartisan drive to overhaul the U.S. criminal justice system. Barack Obama has spoken recently about how sentencing has become disproportionate to crime, how solitary confinement is cruel, and how reentry for those released from prison is made unnecessarily difficult. Well, these are all things that prisoners' rights and activist groups have been saying for decades, of course. So what's new now and how new is it? Could this conversation about fixing some of what's wrong with prisons be expanded to include questions about how and why we have prisons in the first place? Mohammed Sheikh is Media and Communications Director at the prison abolition group Critical Resistance. He joins us now by telephone. Welcome to Counterspin, Mohammed Sheikh.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think that it's a good thing and an important thing that a president is visiting a prison, as Obama is doing this week. Invisibility of the incarcerated is a problem, despite all the sort of pop culture representations we see. But I just wonder, in general, where you place a symbolic act like that, or like the 46 commutations of sentences that Obama handed out. Do you think, well, that's a spotlight on issues that we want to spotlight, or does it feel more almost like a distraction?
It's definitely driven by the fact that the issue of imprisonment in the United States has become such a mainstream issue. People are really looking at the fact that the United States makes up 5% of the world population, yet imprisons about a fifth of the world's prisoners. The president's recent actions are seen by many as, you know, a step in the right direction, but we are very critical of the language of demonizing a certain class of prisoners while using that as justification to release the nonviolent drug offenders that we all see as not having had any justification of being in prison in the first place.
It reminds me a bit of the welfare reform conversation, where you were basically trying to find a method to sort out who it's okay to really punish. You know, who can you punish and just feel good about it?
Exactly. And it also mirrors the conversation around immigration, where you have the narrative of the bad immigrant and the good immigrant, those who deserve to have a pathway to citizenship or just be able to, you know, have access to resources and live their lives, and those who don't. And, you know, Critical Resistance has been doing the work since its founding to break down these distinctions and actually say that all people deserve freedom and that we want to push for the abolition of prisons as a whole and not just for some prisoners.
Well, that's what I want to draw you out on, because there's a lot of talk of reform at the moment. The fact that you have Republicans and Democrats seeming to agree on things for many in the media, that virtually guarantees that this is good stuff and the best we can hope for. Critical Resistance is, as you said, a prison abolition group. Can you talk about the difference between reform and abolition? And can we use this current climate as an opening to have that deeper conversation?
As an abolitionist group, we do work on reforms. But the distinction that we make is, you know, reforms that try and make the system better, in a sense, where we actually see the criminal justice system, the systems of imprisonment, systems of policing, that they are working exactly how they're supposed to. So making them better is actually only going to make them more efficient in criminalizing people, in locking people up, in killing people. And so the reforms that we do engage in is to try and minimize and cut off the resources, cut off the power of these systems. And we have reforms that we work on here in California through our coalition, Californians United for a Responsible Budget, where we work on reforms that try and get people out. And again, like I said, without having to demonize another class of prisoners by doing so, creating pathways for people to get out and really diverting funding that is going to systems of policing and imprisonment into community resources that actually strengthen communities, that produces genuine safety that isn't based on locking people up as a solution to all of our problems. So the fact that the recent conversation has been a bipartisan one, in a sense, it's a good thing in that it's becoming a very common sense conversation to talk about decarceration. But on the other hand, we also want to be extremely cautious of this bipartisanship, because with a lot of issues reaching across the aisle, so to speak, will actually lead to reforms that will produce things that we'll end up having to tear down later.
Well, I think you make an important point that, of course, to be anti-prison entails being in favor of lots of other stuff. You know, it's not a negatively defined mission in that way. It really is about shoring up other sources of power of community.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, this is something that is ongoing in New York, where we have a chapter where they just increased the age of juveniles being able to be in prison, of youth. It was raised 16 to 18. So now you have youth that have spent time in adult prisons that can be released. But on the flip side, now the response is to build up and construct youth maximum security facilities, which is something that we're completely opposed to.
Yeah, we see a same kind of thing with solitary confinement, where we're saying certain people should not be subjected to solitary confinement, which, of course, the unspoken or spoken corollary is that certain people should be in solitary confinement. And that's an area where people might not realize how out of step the United States is with the rest of the world on that.
The international community, the United Nations, have condemned the use of solitary confinement as torture. And so that goes for everybody. That doesn't just go for people that the prison regime deems to be worthy of general population, or what they call, you know, the worst of the worst who should be in solitary confinement. We reject this kind of language, and we think that nobody should be in solitary confinement because it is torture, and it just further entrenches the violence, the control of the prison system in this practice.
Dan Berger, who wrote the book Captive Nation, Black Prison Organizing in the Civil Rights Era, was noting recently that a lot of the people in long-term isolation, that they're disproportionately Muslim. They're often the subject of questionable prosecutions. There are also activists there, social or environmental justice activists there. So being mindful, even as we hear these categories bandied about the worst criminals, it bears thinking who we're talking about there.
Exactly. And when you look at how people are categorized as being subjected to solitary confinement, you actually see that many people on the outside, outside of prisons, would be placed in solitary confinement under the categories that the prison regimes use. So, for example, if you were found with a book by George Jackson, you know, the Black Liberation leader in the 70s, if you had an Aztec painting, you could be placed in solitary confinement for potential gang-related activities. If you were talking about political organizing, you could be placed in solitary confinement. So it's everyday things that you and I would do would get us placed in solitary confinement.
All right. Well, let me just ask you finally, Mohammed Sheikh, we do have this legislation, the Safe, Accountable, Fair, Effective Justice Act, that's going to call for some sentence reductions. This is what's on the table. It's being promoted a lot as saving money, not really about people at all. But would you just say finally that endorsement of an act like that is not a bad thing, even if it's a million miles from where we need to be?
Yeah, so legislation that reduces sentences are definitely a step in the right direction, as long as they're not hardening sentences for other people. And these types of things that, unfortunately, at this stage, we have to utilize to undo the decades-long process of policies that have been put in place that really have undergirded the prison industrial complex. And, you know, it's funny because the former president, Bill Clinton, in his speech to the NAACP said, "I admit it, I made a mistake with a federal minimum sentences legislation that I signed." And, you know, that is exactly one example of just one piece of legislation among hundreds, thousands that have been put in place to really create the prison industrial complex and the situation of prison system that we find ourselves in.
We've been speaking with Mohammed Sheikh of Critical Resistance. Find them online at criticalresistance.org. Mohammed Sheikh, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website. It's FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.